Jeremy asked me to give a review of all the ideas that might be tested at the LHC, which is a ridiculous request. So instead, I'm going to get a review of what's going to happen in 2010. But seriously, this talk is all about the LHC, of course. This is something pretty dramatic that's going to happen in our field in the next few years. Let me just give you a quick timeline. In April 2007, 26 months away, the LHC is going to start with test beams. In the summer of 07 through the winter of 08, we're going to have our first collisions. Those of you who don't know, the LHC is a machine that collides protons on protons with 7 TeV energies each. Not a proton, anti-proton collider, as you'll often see. And by the end of 2008, certainly, we should reach a luminosity of around 10 to the 33 per centimeter squared per second, collect around 10 inverse femtobarns of data, and the obvious question is, what might we know by 2010? Give it another couple of years. It goes without saying, but I'll say it, that this is an unprecedented opportunity for discovering new physics, a real qualitative leap from what we've had so far, LAP and the Tevatron, to what a factor of 10 in energy buys you. Just to give you an example, you like low-energy supersymmetry, the current limits on the Gluino mass, for example, from the Tevatron are something like 250 GeV. That means that they haven't made any. On the other hand, if the Gluino weighs 300 GeV, the LHC will make 1 per second. Okay. That qualifies for the definition of a factory in high-energy physics. So we'll have 10 million of these things in a year. It's an enormous qualitative difference. Some elementary things to keep in mind. It's a proton-proton collider. So it's the usual problem with hadron machines. We don't know exactly what's colliding with what for the short distance interaction. There's a bunch of partons in both protons that interact with each other. We don't know the frame of reference. We don't know the center of mass frame of reference. We don't know exactly the energies of the colliding partons. One thing we do know is that LHC energies, it's dominantly a gluon collider. Okay? The parton distribution functions are biggest for gluons. And this, coupled with the fact that color is stronger than the other interactions, means that the LHC is very good at making colored particles. Just so you have an idea, you can make new colored heavy quarks, for example. You'll maybe make 1,000 of them a year through this kind of process dominantly, two gluons fused, give you a QQ bar. You can make 1,000 of them a year for the heavy quarks up to 2 TeV or something like that. But the analogous process for leptons, the things that only have electroweak quantum numbers, can only make, let's say, 100 a year for lepton masses down to 400 GeV. That's significantly less than the TeV scale. You should not think of this as a TeV collider for everything. It's really a TeV collider for colored particles. Now, what will we see? There's lots and lots of different possibilities, many quote-unquote scenarios, and I won't bore you by going, well, I will bore you a little bit by going through them in a bit. But something that always annoys me is that now we have scenarios. But the last time we had an important accelerator at CERN, which made an important discovery, the discovery of the W and Z in 1984, there were no scenarios. The standard model made a very sharp prediction for where the W and Z were, and their people went out and they found them exactly where they were supposed to be. There's no BS about scenarios. There was a very sharp prediction. So why is it different now? Now we're, you know, what, 3 years away from this machine, and we don't have any very firm, sharp predictions, certainly nothing analogous to exactly where to see the W and the Z. So why is this? I can think of two possibilities. One of them is that we're just dumber than they were, okay? And, you know, you think it's a joke, but I've asked some of the architects of the standard model, and they say no comment. But possibility two is that we have an excuse. And of course, that's the one that I'm going to focus on. The inventors of the Standard Model had seen something that we don't have. They had seen direct evidence for an ultraviolet scale by seeing an irrelevant operator in their low energy theory. They've seen the weak interactions. The weak interactions are an irrelevant operator in the low energy theory, and they have an unambiguous scale associated with them which you can measure. G Fermi, 1 over 250 GeV scale, squared. Okay? They've seen this. They've seen direct evidence for something in the ultraviolet. Our problem is that we do not have one shred of experimental evidence, direct experimental evidence, that there is anything beyond the Standard Model at the TEV scale. At the TEV scale, I stress. Okay? We don't have a single shred of evidence for a higher dimension operator in the low energy effective theory suppressed by powers of the TEV. If we did, it would help narrow down a heck of a lot the theories we're talking about. But we don't. This itself could be providing an important clue, as I will come back to talk about in a bit. But we, first of all, don't have a single direct piece of experimental evidence. But moreover, we have precious few clues of any sort. Okay? Let's just quickly review them. These are all things you know. Particle physics gives you a motivation for having new physics at the TEV scale via the idea of naturalness and the hierarchy problem. There is a big fine-tuning to keep the Higgs mass light, if nothing else, from a loop of the top quark, biggest coupling in the theory. And if you don't believe that such tuning should be allowed, that leads you to suspect that there should be some friend of the top quark of some sort that cancels that large quadratic sensitivity to the ultraviolet. And this argument tells you that that friend should show up around the TEV scale. Actually, notice there's something interesting about this argument, because it leads you to suspect that this friend must also be colored. If for no other reason that there's a factor of three in this diagram from the fact that there's three colors, and you would think that if it's going to be canceled, there should be some other factor of three there. So this leads you to suspect that there are actually colored new particles which mass less than the TeV, and that's important because those colored ones with a mass up to 3-4 TeV might actually be accessible at the LHC. So this argument is excellent for the LHC. Okay. There is a cosmological motivation for new TeV scale physics, which is that if you have stable particles that are weakly interacting at the TeV scale, a very simple calculation of the thermal relic abundance for these particles tells you that the density, the energy density of these particles over entropy is something like 1 over the annihilation cross-section. Oh, that's interesting. 1 over the annihilation cross-section times M Planck, which is something like the 1 over alpha squared, the mass of the particle squared over M Planck. And getting this to work out right for alphas, which are weak interaction strength, tells you that the mass of the particles, dark matter particles, should be around 100 GeV. This is a completely logically independent argument from the previous one. Okay? It's just yet another way that the TeV scale puts in an appearance. Weak scale supersymmetry is so attractive because it combines these two motivations and gives a remarkable bonus, the picture of supersymmetric gauge coupling unification that you've all seen. Although, as we'll talk about, it also introduces a number of problems. So those are sort of theoretical motivations, maybe. Meanwhile, the biggest experimental discovery since the establishment of the Standard Model happened outside particle physics, and has come from cosmology, from the accelerating universe, and the indication that the cosmological constant is not equal to zero, and is given by something around 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth. Can this be a clue for the LHC? This is a theme we'll explore a little later on. But if nothing else, with this experimental observation, there is a little bit of numerology that the scale associated with the cosmological constant seems to be related to the TeV scale and the Planck scale in a suggestive way. Okay, so for the rest of the talk, I'm going to answer or address two questions. First, what might we see? This is the usual, when people give talks like this, this is what you hear. Okay? What might you see? There's a laundry list of different models, signatures, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to talk about that. I'll talk about what we might see in the context of natural theories, and I'll also talk about the idea of the landscape and the possibility that the LHC will actually convince us that an effective low energy theory is actually unnatural, something that none of us expected it to do. And in the last part of the talk, I want to start asking a question and answering a question, which is a little different from what certainly most of you, and certainly even most of us, most model builders, haven't given a lot of systematic thought to this question. How might we know? How will we be able to actually determine what's going on, what the low energy model is from data? So this is something we all have to prepare to do, those of us who care about this anyway, all have to prepare to figure out how we're going to solve this inverse problem and prepare for collider physics in a data-rich era. And I want to tell you about some global strategies for doing this that I've been working on in the last number of months. All right, so first, we have natural theories. We all know that in the standard model, there are two relevant operators, two dimensionful parameters, the cosmological constant and the Higgs mass parameter. There are the only two relevant operators, and they're both ridiculously smaller than any reasonable ultraviolet scale. The cosmological constant is 120 orders of magnitude smaller, and the Higgs mass is 30 orders of magnitude smaller. And because they're relevant operators, it takes a big fine-tuning of the parameters in the underlying theory to make them so small. Now, this fine-tuning bothers us. This fine-tuning bothers us going back to Ken Wilson. There's an unstated rationale for why it bothers us. Namely, most of us don't believe in God. After all, if you have a hunk of metal, and in this hunk of metal there are a lot of electrons, and the electrons have their spins all aligned in the same direction, you could imagine you're one of those little electrons in there, and you have some consciousness, and you look around and you say, wow, why is it that all of the electron spins all the way as far as the eye can see are all lined up in the same direction? There must be a mechanism. There's some reason this is happening. We'll invent some dynamics, some good idea. There's no reason. There's nothing at all. There's just some grimy experimentalists with their hand on the temperature dial, and they care to bring the system close to a ferromagnetic phase transition for their own reasons. There's just no deeper reason than that for why this correlation length is large. In finding these fine-tuning problems unpleasant, we are invoking the fact that we don't believe that there's something like this happening in our universe. We don't believe there's anyone out there who cares, and certainly not to an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 30 or 1 part in 10 to the 120. So in the case of the Higgs mass or the hierarchy problem, solving this problem has inspired a number of approaches, starting with the proposal of Technicolor, going through low-energy supersymmetry, more recent ideas of low-scale gravity and the little Higgs. Some of these ideas are actually related to each other. But I'm going to spend most of the time talking about supersymmetry. I'll talk about the other things. Suppose we have supersymmetry down at the weak scale. The first thing to know is that if we really have superpartners beneath, around the TEV scale, at the LHC, making them will be both spectacular and complicated. Remember I told you that you can make colored particles up to pretty heavy masses, but you can't pair produce the uncolored ones if they're heavier than something. But actually the dominant way of making all the superparticles in supersymmetric theories tends to be from this long, complicated chain of cascade decays in the following way. For instance, colored particles tend to be a little bit heavier in supersymmetric theories than the uncolored ones. So you can make gluinos. You can pair produce gluinos. There's a heavy gluino. And that gluino can proceed to decay. This gluino decays to a squark and a quark. That quark, in turn, can decay to a quark and a weino. The weino can decay to a lepton and a slepton. The slepton can decay to a lepton plus, finally, a photino or a dino that, in most theories, is stable and exits carrying away missing energy. On the other side, this guy can decay in some other way. So what you end up getting out are you produce all the superparticles triggered off an initial set of colored particles that then cascade decay down. So the generic thing you do is you look for events that have lots and lots of jets, because you're making a lot of colored particles. So you look for events with lots of jets, a lot of missing energy, and some number of leptons are very helpful as well. But you can see it's not a very clean process. Okay, it's a sort of messy way of making a lot of stuff. Okay, so there's no doubt that if the superparticles are around beneath 1 TeV, 2 TeV, 3 TeV, we'll make them in droves at the LHC. You'll see it a little more detail in a second. But all of these approaches to the hierarchy problem have the feature that they involve lots of new physics at the TeV scale. And this qualitative fact that all these approaches have sort of a lot of particles hanging around around the TeV scale has been in growing tension with lots of other indirect probes of short distance physics that we've had. In fact, a lot of these experiments were designed to look for indirect effects of new particles at the TeV scale, and the absence of signals is starting to grow a little slightly troubling. For instance, you would expect that new physics at short distances might give us new four fermion interactions that could show up in various flavor changing processes, or electric and magnetic dipole moments, and a slew of other things as well. If there are all these particles floating around the TeV scale, you might have expected to see one of these operators show up with a coefficient roughly set by the TeV scale, maybe with some loop factor or something like that. But instead, the experiments have happened. We don't see any deviations from the standard model, and we conclude by putting limits on the length scale associated with these interactions, which tend to be significantly smaller than the TeV length scale, higher energy scales than the TeV scale. Things like 10 TeV, 100 TeV, 1,000 TeV. And I want to stress that this isn't just for one or two processes. It's from tens, twenties of processes where some effect could have shown up and nothing has. It's not deadly. There was no theorem that something had to show up here, but it's getting somewhat troubling and is known to those of us who think about this a lot as the little hierarchy problem. It's known as the little hierarchy problem because the big hierarchy problem has to do with stabilizing the Higgs mass all the way up to the Planck scale. So we don't know what's happening between here and the Planck scale. On the other hand, the absence of all of these signals for new physics suggests the most obvious reading of it is that there's actually nothing there and that there's a cutoff that's significantly above the TeV scale, thereby reintroducing the fine-tuning problem for the Higgs. Another set of ideas for natural theories are new strong dynamics at the weak scale. Starting with the, again, idea of technicolor, but all of the more recent ideas, like warp dimensions, which are really some dual version of technicolor, or large dimensions. But there's a common problem, a common issue with all of these theories, which is that if you have new strong interactions at the TeV scale, you would expect to find irrelevant operators of the form, roughly speaking, the 4 pi squared, the 4 pi is a strong interaction strength over TeV squared, and a slew of dimension 6 operators involving Higgses and gauge fields, Higgses of themselves, 4 fermion interactions, and so on. Again, there's a whole stack of these operators that could be there, and these coefficients are just about a factor of 100 too big, at least. Okay. So, of course, if we ignore this, these models have potentially spectacular LHC signals, ranging from possibly that we might see gravitational radiation into extra dimensions, black holes, strings, or in these other theories, a bunch of narrow resonances, either with interpretation as Kaluza-Klein modes in a warp fifth dimension, or Techne resonances in a technicolor series. And just to quickly talk about the last new addition to theories that address the hierarchy problem, the little Higgs models are really an attempt to save this idea of strong dynamics by pushing it up to the 10 TeV scale rather than the 1 TeV scale, and saying that the really exciting dynamics is happening up here at 10 TeV, but a few scalar particles survive accidentally down to low energies as pseudo-Goldstone bosons. They have to be a slightly special kind of pseudo-Goldstone boson, but anyway. So what ends up happening is there's some new strong dynamics at the 10 TeV scale. Down at the 100 GeV scale, two loop factors beneath the 10 TeV scale, we have the Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone boson. And then around the 1 TeV scale, we see some new perturbative, weakly interacting particles, which have the property that for a nice symmetry reason, the quadratic divergences that you would normally compute for the Higgs mass are canceled, and they're canceled by partners not of opposite statistics as in supersymmetry, but of same statistics. Okay? So we have a top diagram, and it's canceled by a top prime diagram. The top prime has got to be there somewhere at the TED scale, and although I don't have time to explain it, as in supersymmetry, there are relationships between these couplings that are forced and guaranteed by a symmetry, different sort of symmetry, which makes this natural. But there does seem to be some tension with the idea of having strong dynamics at the TED scale. Now, that's normally touted as one of the virtues of supersymmetry, but it's really not. Because although supersymmetry is weakly coupled, it also suffers from a little hierarchy problem of a very similar type. For one thing, it could have, again, easily already been seen through a whole litany of virtual effects, ranging from electric dipole moments to Clavier-Changer neutral currents, which, again, very generically, you might have expected to be a factor of 100 to 1,000 bigger than what they're observed to be. These things are normally thought of as being somehow associated with the flavor structure or the CP structure of the theory, and there are some mysteries there anyway, so it's not a tremendous problem, perhaps. But more recently, there's been something that looks more like a structural problem, which is that, again, in supersymmetry, one might have expected to have seen the Higgs boson already. And there's a simple reason. If you recall, the Higgs mass is set by the quartic coupling in the Higgs potential. But in supersymmetry, these quartic couplings come from D terms, and therefore the size of this quartic coupling is actually given by a gauge coupling, which you can show quite specifically leads to a prediction that the Higgs boson mass should be lighter than or equal to mz. Now it isn't. We haven't seen the Higgs boson lighter than mz. Of course, this relation is only true in the limit where the theory is supersymmetric, and you can imagine that if you break supersymmetry fairly badly, then you can violate the relationship between this quartic coupling and the gauge coupling, and indeed, that's what happens. If we have the superpartners of the top quark, for example, and if they're sufficiently heavy, then we have a Lorentz effective theory that looks non-supersymmetric, and there's a logarithmic renormalization group contribution to the Higgs quartic coupling, which is positive, it goes in the direction of making the Higgs heavier, but logarithmic in the ratio of the stop mass to the top mass. So you can use this effect to jack up the Higgs and make it heavier and heavier, but it's clear that this is a dangerous game, because at the same time, if you're logarithmically enhancing the quartic coupling, you're getting a bigger and bigger quadratic contribution to the Higgs mass itself, the usual fine-tuning problem. So you can make the Higgs heavier precisely at the expense, logarithmically, precisely at the expense quadratically of making the theory more finely tuned. And that means that getting the Higgs heavier than 114 GeV requires already, in most supersymmetric theories, a fine-tuning of a few percent, at least. Okay. Let me say this another way, because that few percent sometimes doesn't bother me so much, and then I think about it like this, and it bothers me a lot. Okay. A picture many of you have probably seen is that if you start with a supersymmetric theory, and we start with all the scalar masses roughly comparable at some high energy scale, then under the renormalization group, you drive the Higgs mass squared negative due to the top Yukawa coupling. Okay? That's very nice. In fact, that gives you some reason why it's, of all the scalars, it's the Higgs getting a BEV and not, let's say, one of the squarks. Okay? That's actually a very nice feature. But you'd expect, this is just some renormalization group equation, there's some scale where the Higgs mass squared crosses zero, that scale has nothing to do with anything, you just keep running down and down and down until you hit the scale of the soft parameters themselves, and you evaluate the effective potential at that scale. What this tells you is that there's a natural expectation, as I said before, it tends to be the colored particles are heavier than uncolored particles, so you might expect that squarks and gluinos are heavier than Kleptons and Wienos and Dinos. But what about the Higgs? The Higgs isn't colored. You might have naively thought that the Higgs should be down with everyone else, the other uncolored guys, but no. The Higgs has a very large interaction with the colored particles, with the squarks, via the top Yukawa coupling. And that's actually the biggest coupling in town, and it tells you that, in fact, the Higgs wants to be at the same scale as the squarks and the Kleptons. and heavier than, sorry, at the squarks, and heavier than where the rest of the electroweak guys are. A very natural, a very typical spectrum would have looked something like the squarks are 160 GeV, and the Higgs mass is tied to the Z mass scale, as I mentioned a second ago. So you would have expected that this would have been a wonderful spectrum. The squarks at 160, the Higgs at 80, the sleptons at 40, the Beano at 20. Okay? This would have been a perfectly fine, completely natural expected spectrum. In fact, when we say that supersymmetry is at the weak scale, this is what we should mean. The weak scale isn't 1 TeV. The weak scale is MZ. So another way of phrasing the Susie tuning problem is, why didn't we see supersymmetry at LEP? Or for heaven's sake, why didn't we see it at Petra? It's an even earlier experiment that could have seen some of these sleptons if they were that light. Instead, what appears to happen is the picture looks something like this. Okay? If we take that previous picture and we look at how the Higgs mass squared is driven negative, it looks like where we stop the running, where the soft parameters are, seems to have just waited just after the Higgs mass squared crossed zero, and then you stop running right there. Okay? This is very peculiar. These two scales, the scale of the soft masses and the scale where this crossover point happens, have nothing to do with each other. Okay? So it's very peculiar that they should end up right on top of each other. In fact, naturally, they want to be exponentially different. Okay? So that's another way of phrasing this concern with low-energy supersymmetry. Nonetheless, half the time I think, oh, this is we're just making a big deal out of nothing. This is solving the hierarchy problem all the way from the gut scale down to the weak scale, and there's this little dipsy doodle at the bottom. Who cares? Actually, I think that's a sort of principled attitude to take towards it. And certainly, most of the efforts in model building to quote unquote solve this problem, to my mind, are worse than the disease. Okay, so there's no very beautiful mechanism to explain why this is happening. Maybe it's just an accident. The important point is that if weak scale supersymmetry is right, then we will know by string 0,8. Okay, and I think this is really a very sharp statement. And in fact, discoveries don't even have to take place on the time scale of a year. They can take place on the time scale of weeks or months. Okay? In 1 month of running at the standard luminosity at the LHC, for example, this is one of these plots that you can never understand. But very roughly speaking, okay, here are the scalar masses. Here are the Gugino masses. Within 1 month of running, you can rule out this swath with the Gugino's, you know, heavier than 800 here, or the scale is going up to 1.5 TeV. Within a year, you can rule out if there are squarks and gluinos beneath 2 TeV, we'll know it within a year. Okay? And as I said before, they had better be beneath 2 TeV. In fact, they had better have been, it would have been wonderful if they were at 160 GeV instead. Okay? So if they're there, we may not know exactly what it is, but we'll sure have evidence for lots of new things happening by in 3 years this summer. A quick comment. It's ironic that we may, in fact, we'll very likely discover supersymmetry before we discover the Higgs. And the reason is that it's simply tougher to make and see the Higgs. The Higgs isn't colored, so in fact, it's so much tougher to make it that, in fact, you prefer to make it from a loop process involving colored particles than to make them from a tree process involving uncolored particles. So this is the dominant way of making the Higgs. And furthermore, the way the Higgs most likes to decay is through a B and a B bar if it's light enough. And that's too hard to see over just the standard model background of the LHC. So instead, you look for the Higgs decaying to two photons, which is... has a pretty small branching ratio, but still, it's a very clean signal, and you just do a very simple plot. You plot a number of events as a function of the invariant mass in two photons, and you should see a nice bump where the Higgs is. But this will probably not happen until 2009 or 2010, in fact. So it's quite possible that within a month, we'll know there's supersymmetry, and we'll have to wait another 2 or 3 years to know that there's a Higgs. All right, any questions? Let's now talk about unnatural theories. Well, there's a lot of stuff that I can say, but let me, if any of you have heard it. So let's just cut to the chase. The idea of naturalness suffers very seriously from the cosmological constant problem. Okay? And every one of us who has devoted significant chunks of our career to thinking about what solves the hierarchy problem has this nightmare that maybe we just don't understand anything because the cosmological constant, which is a much, much, much bigger failure of fine-tuning, a much bigger failure of naturalness, does not appear to have the sort of solution we have in mind for the hierarchy problem. Okay. Just to state the obvious, if you believe that there's a natural solution to the cosmological constant problem, then we might be tempted to invoke new physics at the 10 to the minus 3 electron volt scale. Could have been supersymmetry at 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. Supersymmetry could have solved the cosmological constant problem. Okay? It didn't. At the 10 to the minus 3 electron volt scale, we apparently see nothing. Okay. So we saw nothing. There's a caveat, of course, which is that it could be that there's something involving only gravity that shows up at 10 to the minus 3 electron volt, which is around the millimeter scale. Maybe gravity shuts off at around a millimeter, and that somehow evades the cosmological constant problem. It would be wonderful to make sense of that idea, but as far as I can understand, there isn't a sensible way to think about it. So there's just a failure of this idea, which is not to say that there may be some very, very deep ultraviolet reason that, since I'm saying the word deep, I might as well put up this transparency. So the reasonable, usual attitude has been that the cosmological constant associated with gravity, which is deep and mysterious, and you say that a number of times, and maybe you say the word holography, and then you agree to ignore it for now. Okay? You ignore the cosmological constant problem, meanwhile making sure that the weak scale is as natural as possible. And I don't want to make fun of this, because it may very well be right. We don't always solve all problems simultaneously in physics. And it could be that there is a natural solution to the hierarchy problem. Someday we'll solve the cosmological constant problem in an entirely different way. So this may very well be right. But it's disquieting that both a very huge thing and a bunch of nagging little things are hinting that something is wrong. It could have been, let me just give you a scenario in which this business about the cosmological constant wouldn't have bothered me at all. Suppose we solve the cosmological constant problem, but we've seen the Higgs boson at 72 GeV, and we've seen deviations in various dipole moments, and we've seen some funny flavor changing neutral currents, and we've seen all of this stuff. Then I'd say, great, we'll solve the CC problem someday. Right now, I'm not going to waste time giving talks. I'm going to hold myself up in my office and find the correct supersymmetric model of the world. Or it could have been that we saw very large deviations from precision electron weak observables, and then again, I would have the same attitude. But instead, we're in this very awkward situation where both in particle physics, where all kinds of evidence could have shown up that suggests there's something going on at the GeV scale, and it hasn't. Now, we haven't pushed that to very, very short distances yet, but there seems to be something a little wrong. And the cosmological constant are suggesting that maybe we're missing a big part of the picture. Could it be that if you believe that cosmological constant isn't natural and it's taken care of by something else, that the same thing will happen to the Higgs mass square? And that there's some kind of tuning mechanism taking care of both of these things together? Now, there will be many talks on the landscape here, so I'm not going to go through the philosophy, but I think you all by now know it. There's a very different approach to these fine-tuning problems, which is to say that there are many, many, many vacua, and if you identify some parameter of the theory where very gross infrared features of the universe, like whether it's empty or not, depend sensitively on that parameter, then you might have a perfectly plausible explanation for why the parameter has the value that it has, simply because if it had a different value, the universe would be empty, and no one could observe it. So there's some complicated potential landscape, and we can't be in any of these places. We can only be there because by Weinberg's argument for the cosmological constant, for example, only there can galaxies in structure form, and later we're going to tunnel into some lethal universe, but never mind. But this really opens up a potentially remarkable picture of the world. Could it be that the non-zero cosmological constant is in fact the first hint that we're part of this vast multiverse with this enormous landscape of vacua? So this picture is, here we are stuck inside our cosmological horizon. We can't yet right now see, we don't even know conceptually quite how to see, but it could be that there are all these other vacua out there, and this tiny value of the CC is actually the first shadow of a hint of this remarkable picture. But the real problem is, how can we know? People invoke often this analogy with understanding the properties of our solar system from very similar sorts of reasoning. There's many solar systems out there, it's natural that we're going to find ourselves on one that has the right Earth-Sun distance to allow water not to freeze or boil, etc. But the problem is that in this picture we don't have a telescope. We don't know how to look and see the existence of all these other populated universes. However, it's still possible to do something with this picture, which is to see whether even the most gross qualitative properties of the world that it suggests might lead you to construct other theories. Those theories themselves would be very, very testable and falsifiable and so on, and make very sharp predictions. But they should be so weird from the usual point of view that if you saw them, you would be really kicked into this kind of picture of the world. And there is a qualitative new possibility suggested by this picture, which is a new notion of naturalness. For instance, should we still expect supersymmetry at the weak scale? And I think the answer is, in this picture, we just don't know. It could be, for instance, I've drawn two regions of the landscape here. Here, the supersymmetry breaking scale is 10 to the 10 GeV, very, very high, far bigger than the weak scale. Here, it's the TeV scale. You might just love to be there, because there, everything is natural and perfect and wonderful from the point of view of particle physics, but there's only 10 to the 40 vacua. You just count and you count and you count, and there's only 10 to the 40 vacua in that region. Well, just tough luck. There's only 10 to the 40 vacua. Much as you love it from the point of view of particle physics, you simply cannot find the vacuum of a small enough cosmological constant in order to make structure. So, on the other hand, over here, there's a much bigger value of the Susie breaking scale. There could be 10 to the 200 vacua. And if there's 10 to the 200 there, that's plenty enough to both fine-tune for the cosmological constant and for the Higgs mass. And you might simply be forced into something that looks very unnatural from the point of view of particle physics, because it's the only place where, from the point of view of cosmology and making structure and making a small enough cosmological constant, you can possibly find a vacuum with the desirable properties. So this is just there may be other ways in which our notions of naturalness can be affected, but I think the zeroth order messages relax your notions of naturalness. But don't relax them randomly. You should still try to attach them to some parameter, some observables, on which infrared physics depends very, very sensitively. Okay? One of them is the cosmological constant, as Weinberg taught us. Interestingly, the other relevant operator in the standard model, the Higgs mass, has a similar thing associated with it. Okay? Weinberg said if you take the cosmological constant and you vary it and nothing else, you can't make structure if it gets too much bigger than what we observed it to be. Donahue et al. Said, take the Higgs mass squared parameter and make it a little more negative. Well, you don't have to make it too much more negative before you no longer have atoms, plural. Okay? The fact that in our world we have interesting chemistry has to do with the fact that we have interesting nuclei. The reason we have interesting nuclei has to do with a lot of coincidences between the QCD scale and the masses of the up and the down quarks. If we simply raise the weak scale, that makes the down quark heavier than the up quark, and pretty soon it becomes so heavy that the neutron can decay to a proton, even in nuclei. The mass difference exceeds nuclear binding energies, and you have nothing other than just hydrogen. Okay? That happens when the Higgs valve just gets 3 times bigger than what we observe it to be. So it didn't have to be that the other parameter of the theory also has an argument like this associated with it. I find this, or rather, whatever else you think, this is kind of interesting. All right, now, the problem with this line of thinking, of course, is that you might naturally expect that it leads you to believe that you'll see the Higgs and nothing else at the LHC. This is example one of an unnatural theory we might discover, the Standard Model. Okay. Now, there's a problem with this, other than depression. First of all, it wouldn't convince us of anything. It certainly wouldn't convince me of anything. If we saw the Higgs and nothing else, I wouldn't all of a sudden be convinced that there's tremendous fine-tuning and there's anthropic arguments that explain the weak scale and so on. I would just think we should have built the SSC. Because as we've seen, okay, the LHC is going into the TEV range, but it's not completely thoroughly exploring it. It's just possible we're barely missing things. And besides, what about these beautiful things, gauge coupling unification and dark matter? Those things were appearing to indicate that supersymmetry was on the right track. Well, there is a possibility that sort of splits the difference. Between these, which is the idea of split supersymmetry. Imagine it's just the supersymmetric Standard Model in a very peculiar limit of its parameter space, where you make the scalars, the squarks and reflectons, much, much heavier than the TEV scale. And at the TEV scale, we have a Higgs, which is finely tuned. So that's the ridiculous thing here. It's a supersymmetric theory, which is also very finely tuned for the Higgs. But the fermions of the supersymmetric theory, the Galeno, Zeno, Totino, Higgsino, are light all down near the TEV scale, and the lightest one of them is dark matter. That's the model. Very simple. First point is that unification works just as in supersymmetry. It's very slightly improved. So in a supersymmetric picture, that's what gauge coupling unification looks like. This is what happens in Split-Suzy. All that happens is when you hit the mass scale of the scalars, the slopes of these lines change, but they still meet at a point. And the reason is that the squarks and the reflectons change the line slopes equally for all lines because they come in complete multiples of SU5. So unification still happens. But what's interesting about it is that with one stroke, this eliminates all of the nagging difficulties of supersymmetry. There's no problem with flavor changing neutral currents, dipole moments, the two light Higgs, variety of other problems all have to do with the scalars. So it's amusing that the concrete successes, unification and dark matter, are associated with the fermions. Everything else, all the problems are associated with the scalars. The scalars are only needed for naturalness, but all of these supersymmetric theories are incredibly fine-tuned to begin with for the cosmological constant. So what's the big point of principle for saying that they better not be tuned for anything else? Now, there's some technical points here that I'm not going to have time to get into. Suffice it to say, in this theory, it's natural for the fermions to all be light, despite the fact that the R symmetries are actually broken by the gravitino mass. And also, there's an interesting point that all of the fermions have to slide up and down together. You can't separate one from the others. Okay? All the fermions either are up at the scale of the scalars, or they all move more or less in lockstep. So if you're going to separate things out, this is the only way that they could be separated. Most interestingly to me, the theory is sharply predictive and can convince us that there is enormous fine-tuning in the particle physics sector of the theory. It does this by making quantitative predictions and a qualitative prediction. The quantitative prediction is that in the low-energy effective theory, there are 5 Yukawa couplings between the Higgsino and the Gauginos, and also the Higgs-Quartic coupling. There are 5 dimensionless couplings, which are all related to each other by supersymmetry, but at the high scale, at the high supersymmetry scale. They evolve under the renormalization group, and at low energies, they don't have the supersymmetric values. But roughly speaking, if you measure their values at low energies, you measure 5 coupling constants at low energies, and if you evolve the ratio of the couplings divided by the supersymmetric prediction, you should find a picture like this. you should find 5 lines converging to a point at a single scale. Okay? If you manage to do this, if you manage to measure all these couplings, this qualifies as a discovery of high-energy supersymmetry. Okay? This is, you know, like many versions of gauge coupling unification. You measure these 5 coupling constants, you run them up, they unify at one scale. But amazingly, you'll see that it becomes supersymmetric at a very, very high scale, and that SUSY didn't bother to survive down to low enough energy to solve the hierarchy problem. Just as it has already not bothered to survive down to low enough energies to solve the cosmological constant problem. But if you see this, this is very sharp evidence for fine-tuning in the electroweak sector. Much more so than if we just saw the Higgs and nothing else. The reason is, this picture allows us a virtual reach to much, much, much higher energies, and can give a pretty convincing evidence that there's actually a desert up to this scale where the theory becomes supersymmetric. That's a measurement that cannot be done at the LHC, very likely. But there's an interesting qualitative thing that you could that would indicate the same thing, which is that in this theory, the Guino is very long-lived compared to what you normally think it is. The Guino decays to 2 quarks and, let's say, the Fotino through a virtual squark. But now in this theory, the virtual squark is very, very heavy, and this gives you a relatively long lifetime for the Guino, something of order a second or... Anyway, it depends a lot on the scale, but very long compared to what you would normally think. And this gives rise to a variety of signals where if you make the Guinos at the LHC, it's spectacular and pretty unmistakable. For instance, if the scalars are heavier than around 10 of the HeV, the Guinos simply exit the detector. They just barrel through the detector. They decay on the moon somewhere. And there's a whole slew of signals. I don't think I'm going to have time to go over this in detail. But let me just say, in one case, the Guino simply exits the detector. In another case, when the scalars are much lighter but still pretty heavy at around 1,000 PeV, the Guinos all decay inside the detector but observably displaced from the beamline. So they decay something like a millimeter or a centimeter away from the beamline, and you can see that. Okay? And again, that indicates that they've lived so long there is no way you would confuse this with a theory where you say, oh shoot, I happened to make the Guino, but I just barely couldn't make the squarks. Okay? That will never happen, because if you just barely couldn't make the squarks, the Guino would still decay like that. Okay? So if you see that there is a displaced vertex for the Guino, you know that the squarks, wherever they are incredibly heavy. Okay? And that gives you just qualitatively a way of seeing directly that this theory is incredibly tuned. Now, I should say something which is a worry. A worry is that with naturalness gone, remember, why are any of these particles down at the TeV scale? There isn't naturalness anymore. Okay? The reason we have these particles at the TeV scale is now a weaker one, WIMP dark matter. Remember, I told you that there's this cosmological reason to expect new physics at a TeV. It's that which is nailing these particles to the TeV scale. And they might even be there, but we could miss them at the LHC. Let me just give you a simple example. Suppose that of these particles, it's the Higgsino which is the lightest, and the Higgsino which is the dark matter particle. Okay? Then you can just calculate, this is very nice, there's no model dependence, you can calculate what the Higgsino mass has to be for it to be dark matter, and its mass must be between 1 TeV and 1.2 TeV. This is not my desire to put it anywhere, this is where it just comes out to be to get the correct thermal relic abundance. Okay, so this gives us dark matter, it gives us gauge coupling. If that was 400 GeV. Okay, but this is the difference between colored particles and uncolored particles that I alluded to earlier. If we had the SSC, there would be no problem. But that worry aside, let me summarize this part by saying that the usual view has been that the LHC will discover a natural theory of the weak scale, probably supersymmetry. But this alternate viewpoint is that the LHC will do exactly the opposite. Okay. It can provide very sharp evidence that the universe is actually tuned in a way that doesn't make all the successes we are used to from supersymmetry an accident. Unification and dark matter are not accidents, but in this picture there are simply hints that were misread for low-energy supersymmetry, whereas in fact all along there are hints for high-energy supersymmetry. And if this is confirmed, the LHC would duplicate and really amplify the shock we felt with the discovery of the non-zero cosmological constant, this time with an amazing tuning in the electroweak sector. To my mind, this would be a striking blow against naturalness and point to a very different set of principles to explain the tunings, and would indicate a big shift towards the landscape, although, of course, our current understanding of the landscape from the top down is not nearly good enough to say whether the landscape predicts split or split predicts the landscape. I'm saying stupidly obvious things. Okay. But the interesting point is that this is a very concrete, testable, falsifiable model, which is very bizarre from the usual point of view and relatively plausible from the landscape point of view. Okay. All right. So let me finally come to part three. How will we know? It's actually pretty plausible that we'll quickly know that there is some new physics. Okay. There are, in fact, very simple observables at the LHC that can just immediately convince you there is new physics. Okay. You turn on the machine, you run it for a few months, and you do a very simple experiment. You just count events that have two leptons, an L plus and an L minus in them. You sum up their four momenta, you square it, and you plot this distribution. And the standard model predicts some shape for this distribution. But if there's new physics with some characteristic energy scale of order 5, 6, 700 GeV, it predicts another shape. There's an additional contribution to this of a very different shape, peaked at a different place, and you can easily see this over the standard model background. So if you just want to know, is there a simple way to know immediately, is there something beyond the standard model? Yes. Very, very easy. Okay? But what is it? Is it supersymmetry? Well, let me give you, I'm not going to have time to explain this, but there's a class of theories that are just very hard to tell apart from each other at a hadron collider. Supersymmetry or little Higgs models with a parity symmetry analogous to our parity, or extra dimensions with a parity, Kaluza-Klein parity. All of these theories have the property that they make particles, new particles, that decay to standard model particles with missing energy. Now, if we could tell the spin of these particles, we might know if it's supersymmetry or not, but ask an LHC physicist whether they can measure the spin of the particles, and you'll get a long bout of laughter. Okay? It's very hard to measure spins. It's very, very hard to get any of this kind of information, and these theories are actually very, very hard to tell apart from each other. Of course, there are some scenarios that would lead to unmistakable signals. For example, these late-decaying gluinos in Spetsuzzi are very hard to fake, but they look very, very unusual. They're not the canonical kind of events. I want to do a little exercise for the time that I have left, and just even assume that it's supersymmetry, but not in one of its funny extreme regions of parameter space. How can we know, again, what kind of supersymmetry it is? I'm not interested in measuring parameter accuracy. I just even want to know very rough features of the spectrum. What particles are heavier than what other particles, and so on. So the question I want to ask, let's say we've been at the LHC for a year. We've collected 10 inverse femtobarons of data. We want to go from the experimental data to theoretical models. Let's even assume it's the MSSM. You might want to be able to distinguish the following two models. Here's, as you can see, two completely different spectra, the Wienos, Binos, Lepton, Squarks, Gluinos, and the Higgsino. Some of them are flipped, the orders are totally different, tangent beta, some parameters completely different. These are very, very different supersymmetric models. You might want to be able to tell them apart. Okay. But I wouldn't have picked that example if you could tell them apart. It's going to be part of the point. Now, the standard thing, you would have thought this is a subject that's been very well covered by collider physicists for many, many years. People do this for a living. But they have not focused on the question, which is, to my mind, and I think the obvious question, which is the most interesting. This is what most of this literature does. Okay? You pick some model. There's some parameter space for that model. There's a map from that parameter space to the signature space, a set of signals you can possibly observe. And what you do is you try to characterize what is the shape of that region given a certain small size here. Then you have assessed about how well you can measure the size of that region, the volume of that region, and so on. Okay, so this is what almost all studies are about this. However, we're interested in the inverse problem, obviously. We don't know what the model is. We're going to get a certain set of signatures from the LHC, and we want to know what is the inverse map. How do we go back from the signature space to the parameter space? Of course, a much more interesting question, and it's very important to know how well we can do this. And I just want to, if I can have 2 minutes, I want to tell you about a global strategy for doing this that I've been developing in the last number of months in collaboration with Gordy Kane, Jesse Thaler, and Lian Tao Wang. I want to just give you a picture for what this inverse map looks like. Maybe I'll do that and then I'll stop, because the picture is actually kind of surprising. Well, I don't know, it's kind of cool. The best of all possible worlds would be, this signature space, by the way, you just take everything you can possibly observe, okay? You attach a number to everything you can possibly observe, so there's some big high-dimensional signature space, there's some high-dimensional parameter space. The best of all possible worlds would be if some little region of signature space that we've measured in the LHC maps onto a little region of parameter space. That would be great. We could nail the theory. That's the best of all possible worlds. The worst of all possible worlds is if this little part of signature space maps onto some huge blob in parameter space, then we don't know anything. Okay. The actual MSSM turns out to be in between. Looks like that. In other words, if you take a little bin in signature space and you map it back, the inverse map looks like a bunch of little blobs covering a relatively large region. What does this mean? This means in the neighborhood of that point, you can nail the parameters pretty well. If you go outside that point, you're not going to agree with the signature anymore. But there's going to be completely different sets of parameters that are also going to agree with the same set of signals. There's degeneracies. There's many small footprints in a large overall region. And just so you have some idea, the little size of these balls in parameter space can be order 5 to 10 GeV. That's pretty good. And that means that if you're in the neighborhood of one of those points, you can't vary the parameters by more than that and agree with the one set of signals. But the size of this blob is relatively big. In parameter space, it's 2, 3, 400 GeV in all directions. In other words, there are order 100 or 1,000 or in some cases 10,000 or more completely different models that agree with the same set of signals. Okay? That's an important point. What people have been obsessing about is figuring out properties of that little dot. Okay? Instead, there's a whole set of these dots which are going to be consistent with the same set of signals. And let me just give you a quick idea of how we've determined this. This is sort of using statistical techniques to try to get a feeling for globally what this inverse map looks like. You might think this should be pretty easy to do. You just do it very brute force. The MSSM is a very specific theory. You just take the parameter space, you divide it up into bins of 10 GeV each, and then you just simulate all of them, and now you know what every single MSSM looks like. But just to give you an idea, in order to run a single MSSM on your desktop, you can maybe do for a year's worth of running at the LHC to simulate that. You can do 100 of them, 100 MSSMs a day on your desktop. So we commandeered 100 CPUs, 100 computers, and we've managed to simulate 50,000 MSSMs, but it's not that easy. But nevertheless, we simulated 50,000 MSSMs where we varied 7 parameters. It's not one of the minimal models. It just has different masses for all the superpartners, but universal in flavor space. So we have different masses of the Wino, Gaijinos, all the Gaijinos, and the Squarks and the Sleptons. And we simulate this using one of the standard event generators. And we have a set of, there are 22 signatures, it turns out, that are very easy to measure at the LHC. They're counting experiments where you measure the number of events with 2 jets or more that have large missing energies with no leptons, 1 lepton, leptons of opposite sign, same sign, 3 leptons, 4 plus leptons. You count them all up. There's something like 22, there are 22 signatures that you can measure. Signature space is formally 22 dimensional. How much time do I have? Okay. So let me just say that I think I can say this. Signals. So it turns out that from some statistical arguments, we can figure out that although signature space looks 22-dimensional, in fact it's very highly correlated, and that the actual dimensionality of the signature space is more like 5-dimensional. Okay? And that's problematic because it means that the total number of different possible signatures that you can even carve out is not very large. The reason why we get so many models there then that agree with the same set of signals is simply the pigeonhole principle. Okay? The total number of MSSMs is much larger than the number of signals that you can have. And I didn't have time to tell you how we determine the total number of how we determine the number of bins. In principle, you'd have to simulate everything that can happen. In practice, there's a statistical technique that lets you do it, simulating far fewer than the total number. In fact, simulating only square root of n numbers of them. Okay, I can tell anyone who's interested in later. But just so you have an idea, and let me tell you how. I don't have time to do that. Basically, the technique is to simulate m MSSMs and see how many of them are how many of them are pairwise the same, or triples the same, quadruples and quintuples, and there's a statistical there's a statistical fit to all of them that works so beautifully that it must be right, and we can conclude that this total number of distinguishable MSSMs is something like 100,000. Okay, and that's just the problem. So there are going to be, so the lessons are, and I'll end, the lessons are that the models, that if you have models for soft terms with relatively few parameters, less than 4, then the free parameters can be well constrained by these signals that we're talking about. But more generally, you need some ideas. It's not a question of grunge work. Okay? You need some ideas for how to expand the dimensionality of this signature space. In order to constrain more general theories, so that, again, the big picture is that you should expect to find order hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, very different supersymmetric models that will agree with the set of signals that we can see at the LHC. It's challenging, but not impossible. So, to summarize, in 26 months, the LHC starts up. Depending on what we see, we are led to very, very different visions for what the future of the field should look like. If we see something like supersymmetry or extra dimensions or technicolor, it's a triumph of the idea of naturalness, but it throws, it leaves the cosmological constant problem in the dark. If we see something like Split-Suzy or one of the unnatural theories, we have proof of fine-tuning and some sort of unification with the cosmological constant. If we see only the Higgs, we'll have no idea what's going on. We might see something we don't expect at all. The real fun begins in the winter of 2008. We should know something by 2010, if not sooner, as I said. Low-energy SUSY or Split-Suzy, if everything is beneath the TEV, we'll know by the summer of 2008. And even just the Higgs, we should have some evidence by 2009 or 2010. So get ready for it. And I just want to end with an invitation to all of you to join us at CERN on July 25th and 26th this year for the LHC Olympics. This is a gathering. It's basically a mock data trial where a fake theory is simulated and presented to a gathered group of theorists as if it was the real thing, and the gathered group of theorists tries to figure out what it is. So it's a little test run of what the real thing will be like. At least it will simulate aspects of what the real thing will be like. And you shouldn't feel any performance anxiety. The model will be presented during this little conference. We'll discuss it for the week, and the truth won't be revealed till Christmas. And if what I'm talking about, and the picture I was talking about, especially in the case of supersymmetry, is right, it's very likely that there will be tens and twenties of different solutions, and that we'll have to thrash it out and figure out which one is right. So I think it'll be a really fun exercise, and I think string theorists and model builders alike can get something out of it. So I really invite you to join us. And sorry for going so long over time. Thank you.